Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to day three of the Chattanooga Film Festival. I am exhausted. I am so tired, but I'm having the best time of my life, as is the case every Chattanooga Film Festival, and today is a special day. As all of you know, I'm obsessed with Monster Squad. It is tied with Jaws for my favorite movie of all time. And last year, I had the unique pleasure of interviewing Andre Gower and Ryan Lambert from the film. And today is, some might say, even more special, because I am back with Andre. Thank you for joining me today, Andre.
Thanks for having me.
And he has worked with filmmaker Henry McComas, right?
That's correct.
All right, cool. For their documentary, Wolfman's Got Nards. Mm-hmm. Henry, thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you. Excited to be here. Not as tired.
Right. Have you all, like, got to enjoy the festival? I mean, have you been out and...
Oh, yeah. We've seen movies. We've been to the parties. We're good. I closed it down last night early.
Did you?
Because today's a long day for me. Because I'm doing more than just premiering and doing our two screenings of our doc.
Yeah.
You're doing, you know, Ryan and I, they're one of the shorts programs is branded after my show on Nerdist called Short Ends. And so we're hosting that and doing the Q&As with the filmmakers. And then we're also doing one of our podcasts, with Ryan and I's Squadcast, later on. I think that's today, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we're doing two showings of the documentary. So,
wow.
I'm watching a lot of movies.
So, Andre, we got to talk a lot about your history last year. For those of you who haven't checked it out, I mean, that's in our archive. I suggest you go back and check that out. But, Henry, I'm really interested in, you know, kind of... your background, and let's start early. I mean, did you grow up with Monster Squad? I would imagine that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that had to be big part of your growing up, right?
Yes. My brother is about 9 years older than me.
Okay.
I was born in the 80s. Let's not go that far back. But there was a VHS that we had that had the Monster Squad on it that he probably ripped from HBO.
Sure.
And we started to pass that VHS around the neighborhood, and every time one of our friends got a hold of it, there'd be a Dracula or a Gill Man, and we'd be sketching on it and adding to it as we're talking about it.
Right.
Flash forward to, because I loved watching movies so much, I started making movies, and I worked at a studio, Pilgrim Media Group. Outside in the parking lot was Andre Gower visiting a friend for lunch.
Wow.
And we got to talking, and we just threw business cards at each other.
And the rest is history.
Yeah, it was a couple months of courting, and we went into this amazing relationship of making a movie.
So, I mean, from your point of view, and I want to get your opinion too, but Henry first, I mean, as a fan, I mean, what was it about this film in particular that you were like, okay, there's a story here. There's more than just, like, a making-of documentary. There's, like, fandom. Like, what was it, meeting other people? Or, like, how did that kind of come about?
When you love something and you're growing up, especially if you're in the horror genre or any kind of genre of film, you are going to love it with all your heart if you love it.
Yeah.
If you don't understand it, they're going to be looking at you like you're the weirdest person in the world.
Right.
So I was going up and down the high school halls, and people would be like, why do you love these horror movies so much? Why do you love movies so much? We don't get it. You treat them like people. They're part of your extended family.
Right.
And I think that's why I was so attracted to this doc. What if we made a movie that explained why someone loved something so much?
Sure.
So they could take it out and be like, you want to know why? Play this.
Yeah.
And then we made Wolfman's Got Nards.
That's incredible. So, Andre, when Henry comes to you and says, hey, I kind of have this idea, I mean, what's...
Andre came to me.
Oh, you came to... Oh.
Well, I had... I think I know your question, so I'll just jump in
yeah,
here.
Yeah, sure.
I really kind of the summer before I ended up running into Henry, as super serendipitously as you could ever have a happening... you know, I had this idea. I was like, hey, I think there's something there where we could do a little fan doc. And, hey, Ryan, you want to, you know, when we go on, because we're getting ready to do our 30th anniversary year, it's like, hey, what if I went and bought a used 4K camera and we just kind of took around and did a really gritty, you know, shitty, you know, kind of handheld thing, and we would just interview some people, and then, like, we'd come home and have one of our editor friends throw together, like, a 45-minute something, and then, like, we'll push it out on our website online for, like, $1 or something.
Sure.
And have it part of our podcast or something. And like, yeah, that's rad. I was like, well, how much would that cost? But, you know, what would they do? How do I plan that out?
Sure.
And we started working on it, and then I started seeing that there could be a little bit more there.
Right.
And some of that was, one of those more theirs was a little more value to it. And I didn't want to underserve it by just me running around with a shitty camera,
sure,
talking to fans, and not have, you know, the quality that it deserved. And, you know, a few months after that, I run into these guys and they're like, you have a doc idea about this, tell us about that. And so, right, can we go to lunch and, like, can we talk about it? And then they crafted this whole thing. It's like, okay, look, here's the deal. We want to do this.
Yeah.
Would you want to do it with us?
Right.
And I was like, well, this seems like the perfect situation, because I couldn't have gone out and figured out it any other way. Like, even if someone had given me, you know, a ton of money and said, now go hire people and make this documentary, we wouldn't have come close to what we've got.
Sure.
Because I would have just gone out and pick a list of, like, crew and hired them out of the phone book, or people I know with one-offs, and they'd be hired guns to make something. From day one, this thing was conceived and started and developed by people who really, really care about this movie. And that shows all through the entire year that we did this, and it shows for the 90 minutes on screen, and that's all these guys.
Sure.
Here's a crazy thing about the documentary. I think it took Adam Green 11 days to shoot Victor Crowley. Ty West 18 days to do House of the Devil.
Right.
If you go into a bigger production, maybe 28 to 30 days.
Sure.
If you're Francis Coppola, 256 days to do Apocalypse Now. But we are going to Overlook next.
Yeah.
On the 20th, and that day will be the 12th, the full year from when we started making the doc.
Wow. So from, like, start to end.
Yes.
That's incredible.
Yes.
I mean, that's...
On average, it takes documentaries about 4 years.
Yeah. I mean, speaking to the guy who did The Power of Glove and of course, Mark Covino, I mean, that's wild.
Yeah. And the reason why is because there's a lot of crew that helped out throughout the making of the movie.
Sure.
But you could narrow it down to Andre, me, Aaron, and Wes. Our crew is very, sure, very small.
And what did Aaron and Wes do on the film?
So, they're producers. We all held the camera.
Sure.
People are wrangling sound.
So everybody was jumping in.
Yeah.
And just
so
hands
it's jack of all trades.
Sure.
It's just, we never thought about it. We never thought about the deadline. Halfway through, Andre would be like, "So we got to show 30 minutes at Fantastic Fest." Okay.
And he got that message about 2 weeks before Fantastic Fest.
Wow.
So we were editing as we were shooting. And if you look at it, I think what we're really proud of is it looks like it was a 4-year doc. The quality and the aesthetic is very high.
That's incredible. So, I mean, to talk a little bit about, you know, you said, I mean, this was for fans, by fans. What is it, you know, from your estimation about this movie that endures so much and that hits people the way that it has and that has stayed with people? I mean, what, you know, you were in it, so I mean, obviously there's some reverence for it there, but what else, I mean, for your money, what do you think it is?
You have to watch the documentary, Mike. We answer that very question. What we wanted to do with, and what we ended up doing even deeper and better than we said, hey, this is our goal.
Sure.
Is to explain why, and you explain this part a little bit better. So I'll start it and I'll let you, sure, I'll tee it up and you hit it
all
out.
All right.
Why people connected with this movie when they saw it for the first time. No matter whether they were the very few people that saw it in the movie theater, right, or whether they saw it on HBO or whether they saw it at their home video store,
sure,
because the clerk behind the counter said, oh, you're going to love this. And then that kid took it to his neighbor and said, you're going to like this. And it found its home. So somehow this movie connected with them wherever they saw it. Wherever you saw it, like, you remembered it the first time, you wanted to see it again.
Absolutely.
It wasn't, there's not many people that saw Monster Squad and didn't want to see it again.
It came from our public library, and I checked it out so many times as a kid that my mother had to buy the copy.
Join the club, Mike. That's exactly what we have, a million of those stories, and that's, over the years, those are the stories I wanted to tell.
Yeah.
And so we cover that, and then with the team that we had working on it, it grew into, why do movies connect with people like that? Why did this movie connect with people?
Sure.
Why did this impact you personally and professionally.
Yeah.
So you're going to see some really amazing stuff in this documentary about some individuals that this movie really was a seminal, pivotal point in their professional life, not just their geek fandom movie loving life, but in what they're doing today. And there's some fascinating names in there.
That's incredible.
Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Do you remember, because you remember getting that tape and running it raw.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you watched it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You remember the experience. So you're sitting there, lights are down, and it just kind of washes over you.
Yeah.
You're transported somewhere, and you're like, I want to live in this world.
It was everything I loved. I mean, because I had already started growing up on Universal Monsters. I think I said this story off air last year, but I grew up with kind of a rough childhood, and it was one of those things of the things that I experienced as a kid. Horror movies were never as bad as those things were. So Frankenstein and Dracula, they were my friends, you know? And so, like, even in Monster Squad, like, as intense as Duncan is, and, you know, I mean, the wolf, I mean, that's my favorite Wolfman of all time, you know? I mean, those were my guys, you know? That's what I wanted more than anything. And so, yeah, it was like, I wanted to live in that movie more than anything in my life.
Have you tried to explain that to other people about the Monster Squad?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things, like, it comes up on the podcast a lot, you know? I mean, it's my Insta handle is Wolfman's Got Nards, you know? So it's like, you know, I mean, and it's one of the, I mean, dozens of variations, you know, but yeah.
So our goal was to take that emotion that you have, that personal emotion that you got from the very first time you watched it, to wanting to be best friends with the monsters and trying to share that with the world.
Yeah.
And we wanted to capture that first viewing experience from the beginning of the movie in the movie theater and take people on the ride, whether they've seen it or not.
That's
until
incredible.
When they're in the end, they're like, I have an emotional connection with this movie.
That's incredible. I mean, that's why I've been so excited. I mean, Andre mentioned it a little bit last year. We didn't talk about it very much. But that's incredible. That's an incredible experience.
Yeah, this is very interesting to talk, not to cut you off, but you mentioned something awesome because I said we're going to start working on this thing because we hadn't started yet.
Yeah, that's right.
It was a couple weeks later.
Yeah,
we had done the deal. We were prepping and getting ready, and our first actual roll of the cameras was at Spooky Empire on April 20th a year ago. So you and I had just talked about that we were just getting ready
that's
to,
so wild.
And now here we are premiering it at you know, a year later.
A year
so
later.
It's kind of like
you're
a part of it.
You're part of the narrative.
You're a part of the overall story.
Well, that just makes my heart swell. So, I mean, talk a little bit about, you know, production. And I mean, obviously you talk to a lot of fans, but talk a little bit about, like, you know, some of the people from the film that you got to talk to and what that experience was like.
Andre directed the movie, and he had connections to everyone.
Sure.
It was not hard to lock down an interview, whether it was an EP of a major show or it was just an awesome fan.
Right.
It was easy to get everyone, and they all wanted to do it because of their attachment to the movie.
That's incredible.
I'd say probably top-notch for me, the best interview experience was Fred Dekker. Like, when you watch the movie, you'll notice the sun's up in the background, and at the end of his interview, it's pitch black because we were there all day.
And it also goes kind of with the emotional arc of his... Because we interview people from the movie, we interview people that made the movie, and we interview fans in, you know, Denver, Colorado, and Winchester, Virginia. But all the interviews are the same. It's about how did this movie affect you personally and professionally.
Sure.
And Fred Dekker is just the same as that person in line in San Antonio, Texas.
Right.
He's telling his story and his personal connection. Now, Fred's obviously is a little bit different.
Sure.
And is sort of the anti-celebratory interview of fans of this movie.
Right.
Because he has a different connection to it.
Sure.
And that's one of the best. Henry really loved that day we spent with Fred because we got the connection and the story that Fred has with it.
Filmmaking creative-wise, there wasn't a moment more inspirational in my life than that day because of how honest and candid he was.
Sure.
And it's not that he didn't dislike something or he didn't like something. It's that I'm a creator, and I have this relationship, and it's complicated, and let me put it out. And I'll go on record to say that there won't and isn't a Fred Dekker interview like this out there. Tom Woodruff Jr., who designed Frankenstein, was also the man inside the Gilman suit.
Right.
And he was, it was the first time he was in a suit. And he really wanted to do it. From doing that on the Monster Squad, it transitioned into him being Pumpkinhead, Alien, yep. The Predator, any gorilla on a Hollywood screen.
Right.
And it's the thing he loves doing today. So, flash forward 30 years now, The Predator's coming out. And The Predator is written by who?
Fred Dekker. Fred wrote it, right?
Fred Dekker and Shane Black. The first time they've co-written a movie since the Monster Squad.
6 Degrees of Monster Squad.
And The Predator is being designed by Tom Woodruff Jr.
That is incredible. Yeah. It's just wild to me that one moment in film history, just the ripple that it has sent out. And I mean, I'm sure it's true of other films too, but there's just such a, it's like emotional, but it's also a physical impact. And it just, I don't know. This is such a special thing. I mean,
it sounds like Mike has seen the doc already. Yes.
Did
we get Mike a presser of this? But here's what's interesting. That's what we set out. We knew that's what we had to make. Sure. That's what we wanted to make.
Sure.
And you would have come up way up short if you didn't embody what, like you just said, to try to, and Henry explains it better, of how to, we wanted to show that.
Right.
And how do you do that in documentary form?
Right.
In a year.
Yeah, sure.
And like what I was going to say before is because you, someone like Mike, like you, that has shown it to you, how do you?
Andre's pointing to someone off camera.
Our producer, Ashley.
Sorry, I was pointing to Ashley. I forgot. I do a podcast. I should know that. And for you to say it's emotion, it comes around. This doc is made for you,
right?
And hopefully, that comes across that way because that's really what it is.
I mean,
and I haven't seen it. No audience has seen it.
Sure.
So hopefully we have some Monster Squad fans that really can and will really dig it.
Right.
And then some people that have never seen it, they're just watching a doc. And so that's that other half of it, right? Henry always were, you know, it's like we made a great thing where people that don't know what Monster Squad is will enjoy this doc and may be inspired, you know, whatever. That's awesome.
Right.
The Monster Squad fans are going to love this.
That's great.
Hopefully.
Right. So I think we talked a little bit about this last year, but Henry, as a fan, one of the things that's always surprising to me as a fan is that there's not a lot of like merch or like that for as much of a fandom as there is, and there's a lot of really great like home crafted stuff and like fan stuff. Why do you think that there's been that hesitance to like embrace? I mean, we're such a nostalgic culture. Why aren't there Monster Squad like Funko Pops and that kind of thing? Is it more like a rights thing, or is it, do you think it's...
You want the honest answer?
Yeah, sure.
Because it would be less cool.
Really?
It's so fucking cool that most of the merch that's coming out is designed by the fans themselves.
Yeah.
It's so cool that this is a thing where if I'm wearing a Stephen King Rules shirt and somebody says, oh, I love The Shining, they have no idea I'm wearing. If somebody says Monster Squad, then we're in the same goddamn club.
Right.
And if it started being on lunch boxes and backpacks and everything, and it wasn't that kind of con environment where it's these people that own these trades because they love all of the pop culture they're creating, it would be less special.
Sure.
You mean like Disney and Star Wars?
Yeah.
Wait, did I say that? Oh, were we recording? But it's, you know, when someone loves Star Wars like I do, and then someone like Disney gets it, and now it's everywhere.
Right.
It feels like it's almost diluted from you, right?
Sure.
So you make a great point. Yeah. Would someone like me that's associated with Monster Squad love to see all this merch? I wouldn't get any unless I owned the rights and I was the one selling it.
Right.
But I don't even think I would still keep it cool.
Yeah.
I think it's a perfect point that Henry made is that's part of the other kind of it's not for everybody.
Right.
And not everybody understands it and not everybody loves it. A lot of people do, but not everybody.
Right.
And, you know, I think homeboy from
a fan made Matt. This Fright Rack shirt.
Yeah.
A fan made your amulet pin.
Yeah.
That's wild.
The same fan, but yeah. Yes. But
yeah. I love a soundbite that Matt has in the doc. He says, everybody knew who Freddy Krueger is, but not everybody's a member of the Monster Squad.
Yeah. 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 And I think that's, it is. I mean, it is a club. It is a, you know, it is.
Yeah.
I mean, when you
And that makes you tighter.
right.
Yeah.
If I meet somebody, I 2 years ago or two falls ago, I directed Evil Dead the Musical, and
that was awesome.
Oh yeah, it's a great. I mean, it's a great show. But it was one of my cast members who I wasn't as close with at the beginning. We started talking one night, and I was talking about taking some friends to see Monster Squad, and he goes, "You want to see Monster Squad?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "I grew up on that fucking movie. I love that movie, you know." And it was immediately like, "Oh, now we're best friends," and you know, like it would just made it that much easier to, you know, connect with somebody. And it's interesting, like the career thing. The first movie I made, one of the characters was called Frankenbomber, and the idea was that he was this like Frankenstein's monster that you could explode and put back together. But his crate was like, I made it as much of a replica of Frankenstein's crate as I could, you know, with Bavaria on it and everything. And it touches every part of a person's life, you know? And I mean, that's huge.
Yeah.
You know? So what,
and I'm not throwing shade, but I'm not going to watch, I mean, I've seen it. I'm not going to be on the Ready Player One train.
Right.
Until I see some Universal monsters in the sequel.
Sure. Like, yeah. Yeah. I totally get that.
Well, you're a monster dude anyway. Yeah. Right?
Unfortunately, we're running out of time. But, I mean, is this the final page of the Monster Squad saga? Like, do you think that this is a...
You know, if it is, then I'm super appreciative to have been a part of the whole thing. Sure. And got to be a part of the team that made this documentary. And if that's the closing chapter, then I think that's pretty rad. But what other people, you know, I don't know. I know a ton of fans want more. What is that more? I don't know. I think the only thing that you could ever do is a sequel. Don't reboot this thing.
Right.
Because that would be like making merch, and you're going to dilute the original. And you know, they were remaking it.
Yeah.
They, you know, back in 2009, 2000.
Every,
you know, they
every
were.
Every time they mention a reboot, it's like.
And people went. They got out the pitchforks,
yeah,
and the torches, and they were hunting the people that were, you know, talking about making this, and that eventually ended up not happening.
Right.
And fans rejoice. I mean, they really is like, please don't mess with my thing.
Sure.
You've kind of stepped on almost everything else that I hold dear in my life, but I will fight you in the parking lot over Monster Squad.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that's kind of the thing we want to kind of capture in this, and we do. Is it the last thing? Who knows? If it is, I feel pretty cool being part of it.
Sure.
And we get to share it with you.
Henry, how do you feel about it?
I think it's a new adventure.
Sure.
30 years ago, Andre was in front of the camera as a star. And now he is premiering his movie behind the camera. When I was a kid, I wanted to be part of a Monster Squad, and I wanted to kill monsters, and now I make movies with the Monster
right.
Squad. This movie has impacted people in many different ways, and it lit a match in the industry and inspired a world of fans. And I think now it's time to see their stories.
That's pretty great. That makes me a little emotional. Like, that's...
Mike, you're going to like this doc. I know you're going to like this doc.
I'm going to sob like a baby during this documentary.
You're not the only one. I have a filmmaker friend of mine that saw the 30-minute cut and cried four times.
Yeah, I'm not ready for this. Well, I wish we could talk for forever about the documentary and about Monster Squad.
Well, we'll have to do it again after you see it.
I would love
How about that?
Yeah, that would be great. Andre, thank you so much for joining us. Henry, this has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, and we're fans. So
yeah, awesome. Thank you. Well, for Bigger Show, this has been Mike D. Please continue to check out the rest of our Chattanooga Film Festival coverage. It will last for forever. There's going to be so much content. This is our season premiere, so we do this every year. And enjoy, and we will see you next time. Goodbye.
Bigger Show.
Watch Wolfman's Got Nards, a documentary.
Hey everybody, Mike D here. This is actually a two-part episode. What you're about to hear is what we recorded after the Chattanooga Film Festival. I got a chance to chat with Andre and Henry again after I actually got a chance to see the film. The only thing to note, the first 10 minutes of this part of the episode is a little rough. We were using a new recorder, and the levels got a little high on the call end. So the first, you know, 10 minutes are a little distorted, not unlistenable by any means. And then it's fine from there on out. I'm really happy to be able to share this one with you. After seeing the documentary, it really, it was important to be able to talk to Henry and Andre again. So I hope you all enjoy, and we'll see you on the other side. Are you guys ready?
We are.
Awesome. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is part two of our Wolfman's Got Nards documentary interview. I am joined again by Henry and Andre. Thank you guys so much for coming back on.
For sure. Thanks for having us. Feels like we time traveled.
I know, right? It's been a busy few weeks for y'all, huh?
It has been, yeah.
Insert special effects sounds here.
it's just the quantum leap sound effects looped and looped and looped. Yeah. But before we, I want to talk a little bit about the film, because before the interview, I hadn't gotten a chance to see it, and it was the very last thing that I saw at the festival, and it naturally made me a complete emotional wreck. And I want to kind of talk about, you know, what has the response been so far? I mean, it's... I would imagine a lot of people are having a similar reaction that I had.
Yeah, but I think you're the only one who cussed us out afterwards for making you cry so much. No, I've had more than one, so Mike, you're in good company.
Okay, good.
It's like, we've had a few that, you know, have... I think everybody kind of connects and resonates with the emotion in it. And sure. It's not... You know, it's not like a documentary that, you know, hits you over the head with a bag of sand for an hour and a half.
Right.
But, you know, there's some people connect with it, and it brings them into that sort of, they remember that feeling and that emotion, and everybody kind of gets affected by that, which I think kind of works. What's interesting is it works in the normal places for the majority of people, and there's a couple of spots that it works differently for other people, which was kind of an added bonus, but it's all balanced off with the fun and the laughter and the funny stuff too. So,
sure.
You know, it's interesting having a documentary that almost seems that someone, you know, that we wrote ahead of time, like a narrative script story to say, hey, we're going to bring it up and down and up and down here and take you on a little bit of a ride through your time, your own time capsule,
sure.
And your own kind of, you know, history with yourself. That's what everybody kind of seems to be saying, is like, I just went right back into my own history of my own world, and it just kind of dinged it all.
It's been such a blast taking it to these festivals. We've had 4 screenings now, and every audience has been different, and every audience has been unique. My favorite part is to sit in the back row and just watch.
Sure.
And wait. And what will happen is full-grown adults will be in an audience together sharing this experience in a movie theater, and one by one, they'll start to cry together, and they'll start to laugh together. And at parts we didn't even necessarily know were going to be an emotional impact. And so it's just been very rewarding to see people get these emotions, both happy and sad, and sharing them together. I mean, it really makes a testament for why we should go see these things in movie theaters. And recently, we just took it over to the Overlook Festival and had 2 great screenings, and that's when we found out we got the audience award, so I guess it means audiences are liking it. I guess,
and congratulations on that. I mean, that's huge. That's a great accomplishment.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, you know, you go to festivals and you know there's juries and there's audience awards, and really as a filmmaker, when you go to festivals, you know, awards are nice, but, you know, being selected to screen in something is, you know, kind of is the prize.
Oh, sure.
And which is, you know, nice to be recognized, and you get into something that there's not everybody gets into everything.
Right.
But then, you know, to come away with any type of award is awesome. And jury awards are great. But especially with something like this, to get the audience award, that means what you made connected with the people, not just the experts.
Sure. And I think, I mean, it really is one of the most, you know, well-crafted documentaries of its kind. I mean, just because it functions on so many levels. I mean, obviously the kind of making of aspect is really neat. But it goes a lot deeper. And I mean, one of the things you had warned me about going in was Fred's material in the film. I wanted to talk a little bit about that, because I think the thing that he says about, you know, shooting a basket in 87 and it not going in until like 2005, 2006 is one of the most impactful things in the film. I mean, that was just such a really, I was really taken aback. I mean, I teared up at that just because the complicated relationship he has with the film is really clear, but it's also so, like, I was overjoyed to hear him say, this is my favorite thing that I've done. Mm-hmm. What was that like? We talked a little bit about it, but I mean, now that, you know, we're on the other side of the film, what was that whole experience like, just, you know, getting such honest reactions from him about the film?
Fred's interview was the most emotional experience for me working behind the camera, because I was in this room and I'm a filmmaker and I'm hearing this man talk about his experiences, and then that's when you start to see that he has a love-hate relationship, and he's so candid and he's so honest, so you can't be frustrated or anything, because what he's doing is he's putting himself out there for you. And as a creative listening to that, it ended up being where someone could take it as a sad interview, or as, it's really interesting seeing Fred in the movie playing for the audiences, because sometimes audiences laugh at what Fred says. And then the other times they respond in a totally different way. And so I think that goes to show the duality of that interview. But personally for me, while we were filming it, it is by far the most inspiring thing I've ever experienced, because it means that I can make something and put it out into the world tomorrow, and it could be deemed by everyone as a failure.
Sure.
But that means absolutely nothing, because time hasn't told the narrative yet. And 30 years later, what could be deemed as a narrative, as a failure, is now considered an ultimate classic.
Right.
And I found that very unique.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting just to hear what fans had been echoing for so long, you know, kind of come out of his mouth. And I don't know, that was just such a kind of an incredible moment. And I mean, seeing, you know, like Shane Black and his material, I thought was really interesting. And then some like surprising stuff like Heather Langenkamp and Chuck Russell. And I didn't expect to see them at all. But it's interesting because they come from a background of films that are also kind of, you know, honored in the way that the Monster Squad has been. What was it like sussing out the, you know, those subjects and like discovering those people and that whole process?
Well, that's sort of the neat thing when that happens, that you don't know is on the plan when you're making a documentary. You know, you set out from the beginning and prep a production such as this, and you know you're going to be going on the road, or, you know, you try to schedule some things at your home base, and you think you know what you're going to have from start to finish. And that's your framework. And what I learned firsthand, but also, you know, over the years, you know, I've been to festivals and know a lot of great filmmakers that, you know, do exclusively docs or have done docs, and they're like, just wait till you get in the middle of this thing, man. It's going to completely change, or it may go 180 on you, or it's going to turn left before it comes back right, and then you get back centered, and this whole thing is going to go upside down a couple times.
Sure.
And that's a really interesting thing, because we had a pretty good framework of what we wanted to cover, and had we just gotten those, we would have hit our goals and had a pretty decent documentary. But throughout our year of shooting this thing, technically a little bit less than a year, we ran into these great examples and opportunities that, you know, weren't planned. Or you run into fans and get these stories that are completely coming out of left field. And that's, they end up replacing a lot of the stuff that you already had in those spots.
Sure.
Because better, or they completely change the story in this section, or they completely rewrite your framework. And it just makes it better and deeper. And I think that's kind of what happened, especially for, you know, kind of from my perspective on this thing. And even something like Fred's interview, you know, you add something like Chuck Russell and Heather Langenkamp. We were at an event in Philadelphia, I think, on that one. And we asked if they'd want to sit down and talk about how films affected them or people. And it was a great example because they explained the movies that affected them as youngsters, right, or as adolescents or young adults. But it's interesting to hear that come from two individuals, different positions that are also responsible for affecting other people. So that just makes your questions a little bit more multi-layered and deeper when you see them later, because you're like, wait, Chuck Russell is talking about movies that affected him. Sure. I thought we were going to talk about the Chuck Russell movies that affected everybody else. And, you know, so that's, we knew that going in, and that's, you know, kind of the questions we wanted to ask all of these names and faces.
Aesthetically, that interview with Chuck Russell and Heather Langenkamp kind of set the creative tone of our movie, because we shot that very early on. So here we are in this kind of VIP room of an underground punk rock venue.
Wait, was it a VIP room, or was it just the room next to the Pisser?
It was definitely a room next to the Pisser, and we're with them, and it's hot, and there's music going on in the background. So we get the cameras out, we telephoto in. We're using some of the light around there, and we're getting this very personal experience. And then we looked back at it after we shot it, and we're like, this is the doc. This is how it's going to look. And so it really set the tone for the rest of the film.
I wonder, too, I mean, I love the opening of all of these people, you know, kind of going through these films that have affected them. And it really, I mean, Chuck and Heather and, you know, like Seth Green and everybody. I mean, it was just kind of a really, you kind of, I think for me, I expected to kind of jump right into Monster Squad, and to frame it in that way was really interesting. Was that an aha moment, or did you have, you know, I know we talked before, there were a lot of different kind of narrative structures to the film. What were some of the aha moments as you went along?
Well, I mean, that it comes from Andre's vision, because it doesn't matter how high of a celebrity you are, we're all fans at one point. So we've all been inspired by a movie or someone else's art that has then put us on our career or our path, or motivates us to get in the car and go to work in the morning. And we wanted to get some of our bigger names, put them in the beginning, and show them how they're just like us.
Sure.
And they're just like the people who love the Monster Squad.
That's really, really interesting. I mean, one of the other kind of cool things that has come out of this, I mean, just in posting about the film and about, you know, the festival and meeting, albeit, you know, over the internet and over social media, meeting other fans, and a lot of which are featured in the doc, who have like reached out and, you know, and asked about the film and, you know, have mentioned that they were in it. And it's just, I just think it's kind of an incredible tool that is still uniting fans all over the world. And I think that that's probably going to continue as more people see it.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, thanks. I think that's an interesting dynamic that I'd always, you know, you always kind of hope that, because sure, someone like myself, who's so inside of this world, you know, with Monster Squad and the fans, you understand that that's that connection. And I have been, you know, almost everywhere you go as, you know, representing Monster Squad, or as, you know, the guy in Monster Squad, you'll meet a fan. And then there'll be a fan standing behind them, or we're talking on the side, or having a, you know, having a beer or something. And then those people become pals.
Sure.
Because they can connect on something that is not, you know, superficial. And that's sort of how the original movie did anyway. And so, like you were saying, which was very interesting, that even this documentary is now restoking that kind of dynamic with people that are finding each other when they didn't know they were out there, or they now they know they're out there. Now they just have the vehicle to connect with.
Sure.
And the conduit to do it. So look, if this documentary, the only thing it ever does is, you know, serves as a conduit for other people to get together and enjoy the stuff that they like, I mean, that's a pretty cool takeaway also.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and to go back to the beginning of that movie sequence where people are talking about their favorite films, is we know that this movie is about life after death and the 30-year success story of not only the movie Monster Squad, but the audience and fans that love it.
Sure.
but there's something that can connect to other people that may not have experienced the Monster Squad, and that's the relationship between an audience and their favorite movie. So it's important to get people to remember, oh yeah, I remember the first time I sat in that movie theater and saw something I loved, and then they're on the ride with us from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, I think it transcends nostalgia in that way. I mean, it you see so many, you know, special features and things like that that talk to fans, and this just went above and beyond. And I mean, I think it goes back to that, those early Alamo Drafthouse screenings, when you see how many people wanted it, you know, immediately. I think that's really incredible. Were there any, I mean, just as like a fan of the movie, and, you know, as I was kind of looking for people in the doc, were there any people that from the film that you weren't able to get that, you know, you were kind of disappointed, or did you feel like it didn't really matter in the end?
There's a small handful.
Sure.
That were on the very, very top of the list just because they're giant names. And, you know, one of them happens to be a giant Monster Squad fan. And it just, you know, scheduling and being an A-lister and timing and, maybe not being able to, or maybe not really being interested, but, kind of still on the line. Maybe they can always do something and follow. You never know what can happen.
Sure.
And even if it was just a follow up something or something to, you know, beat a screening and intro it or something. But yeah, there was a handful. I know my top two that we didn't get. It's really kind of top one. That would have been amazing. But, you know, it's not over yet. But that was – are we naming names? Are we naming names?
We'll just say that we'll be knocking on Young Hercules' door until we distribute this film.
That's incredible. So yeah, but, I mean, it seems like it's been kind of a whirlwind. I mean, what was the audience at Overlook like? And you know, I mean, you touched on it a little bit, but I kind of wanted to, I mean, just seeing it from the outside was incredible. You know, what does the next little bit look like for the film?
They were spectacular. It was really cool. The first screening was awesome, but the second screening, we didn't know. I mean, I maybe knew two people in that audience.
Wow.
Right, yeah. Which is a good thing. You know, yeah. It's not just, yeah, the people you know come to see your thing. And it's, yeah, you were right. We had a really good crowd in the second screening that just had really kind of hit. And people got it, because I think people were talking about it, you know, over the course of the festival, and the best screening was the last one, which was on the last day. And that's a great festival. Anyway, I had never been to Overlook before. I hadn't been when it was the Stanley either. And they run a pretty good event as event goes, and they have all these other activities and experiences to do.
I'm still drunk.
I'm still tired. And this thing was a week ago. And, so, you know, to enjoy an overall good event that's ran really well, and the logistics and the timing and the scheduling and the staff, you know, that just makes the overall enjoyment to something, you know, even more rad. But then to also have really good showings and screenings and people talking about your movie at a film festival.
Diva came out.
Yeah, even, you know, Diva Zappa was there because she was a part of the experiential, you know, team of that festival. And sure. I love whenever I can see Diva Zappa, it's a win for a day. And, cause I've known her literally forever.
Right.
And she's such this, you know, amazing kind of, it sounds so corny, but she really is, a bundle of energy and a different spirit
and joy
of her own. And she just brings like a, whatever it is, like she has a different harmonic. And it's like gravity. And
Fangoria was there. Fangoria was amazing. Just like they hosted one of our screenings, and just the idea, dude, how crazy is it that we're going to get a Fangoria magazine this year?
I mean, it's nuts. It's wild.
Isn't it? Like, May 1st is when you can start subscribing, and I'm definitely giving them my subscription first thing in the morning.
Well, it's what's funny is Henry, you know, was like, oh, my God, it's Fangoria. Fangoria's back. I'm like, yeah, I heard. That's awesome. You know, Fangoria's giant. It's good. And he was like, no, you don't understand. It was, you know, when I was – I'll tell Henry's story here. He's like –
And he tells us to the guy now running Fangoria. He's like, I just want to tell you something. And, you know, it's like there were two magazines in my life that I was never allowed to have but always wanted. And one was Playboy and the other was Fangoria. And, you know, and now that I have a chance, you know, I grew up and I read Fangoria anyway. I read Playboy too. But, you know, now that I can get Fangoria as an adult and I know what's going on in there. I mean, Henry's like, you know, flying through the stratosphere. And he, you know, he's like, isn't this awesome that Fangoria is going off? I'm like, no, yes, it is. I've already said it. And I was like, this is different from Henry. I've already been in Fangoria, the original, and it's awesome. And I get it, and I'm glad they're resurging because it's going to be a whole other, you know, whole other fan base and the original fan base. So it's almost sort of like a little, you know, I can share in that resurgence because I know what that's like a little bit.
It's an 80s reunion.
Yeah. And I think they're going to do some cool stuff because, you know, the guys running it, the guys and the gals running it, it's a great team that they have. It's very small right now, but I think they're compiling some cool people.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're looking forward to that. But to be associated back with something like a brand like Fangoria at something kind of new in a new city like Overlook with a movie that you did that's talking about all of these things, that you almost couldn't package that together better.
It's like the documentary of the documentary.
Yeah, right. There's a documentary of the feels and the history and stuff. So I thought that was pretty neat. So I don't know if that's going to get replicated anywhere. Like I think every festival we, you know, get lucky enough to be into and screen and get to participate in on site is going to be a different awesome experience. And I think they're all going to be singular. And this one certainly was because of something like that, with the added elements of how they ran their event, who they had there, what they had going on, the Fangoria experience. You know, I rarely go to film festivals and see a lot of movies, but I saw like, what, 5 or 6? And we all enjoyed that. Yeah. We became patrons of the festival and enjoyed it all too. So it was a great experience with all of that cool stuff wrapped up in it, just made it rad.
Here's That's something awesome. You're going to hear a lot from me, Mike. Every festival from here on out, you're going to hear, that's my favorite festival. I really feel like it while we're there doing it. They've all been so good so far.
That's great.
You're 2 for 2. And you started, good. We've had two kind of good festivals back to back that are kind of just whirlwinds. And, you know, each experience just gets stronger and stronger, which means down the road it's going to be crazy.
Sure. Absolutely.
Well, I know it's still early, and I know you probably can't say very much, but can you maybe hint at when people might be able to see, you know, the audience at large might be able to see the documentary?
Ooh,
after the festival.
So. Sure, sure, yeah.
I would say at least, I think our festival run is going at least through fall.
Okay.
I've been telling people to write in a letter to Santa Claus and maybe something will show up under their tree.
Right. And if Santa Claus's address rhymes with all the studios that are interested or some of these distributors, you can CC them on there as well. Or now you don't have to write letters. You can just tag them on some social and get some stuff. So
tweet Santa.
tweet at Santa, at all these studios that we're talking to. Hey, we'll come up with that campaign. We'll give you a list of the hashtags or the handles.
A shout out. Sean Robert, get on it, man.
So
I think we can get it done if we just activated Sean Robert.
Yeah.
So I mean, one of the most impressive things in my experience with getting to know both of you and to see the film is that you have worked, you know, incredibly well together, and you have a kinetic energy together. I would imagine that this is not the last project that you'll work on together. Can you talk a little bit about maybe if you have anything else in the works?
Yeah, Andre and I have, like, throughout the full year, I mean, maybe day two when we started working up the dock, we're talking about the next projects we'll be working on. We got a couple scripted narrative feature ideas and some series as well, all within the genre place that would make your face melt.
Yeah, I'm kind of running the gamut of scope and scale as well. Some are, some scripted narrative short form web, short form series type stories, projects, all the way up to, kind of modern day mid-major, genre budget type stuff, which is, kind of interesting.
Well, creature features and ghosts.
Hey,
creature features, ghosts, cerebral stories, psychological stuff. There could be some monsters in there somewhere, but yeah, it's I like you said, it's been interesting. I think Henry and I think, and it shows in this thing, because I had to learn, or I had to adjust something that I normally do in my own mind, is to be completely, you know, gripping onto something, you know, with all of my might and not budging off something. And I got really comfortable early on with Henry, just on the technical aspect of stuff, because I think we worked well early on in kind of setting the tone or the stage or what I thought we should be, you know, achieving or acquiring.
Sure.
And then Henry executed that, but you don't see that for months down the road. And then, you know, to see the technical proficiency, you know, marry up with the creative skill that Henry has, really impressed me, mid late into the game. And I was like, you know what? I don't even, I think I'm going to sit back and enjoy this. I'm going to absorb what gets, put in front of me, and then I'll chime in with some ideas or notes. But I think we worked well enough together from day one that there wasn't a lot of, there's no hassling or wrangling or, you know, throwing rolls of, you know, bagels at each other or anything like that, that you hear all the time. And this thing just kind of flowed on its own, and which made my job, you know, easier. Sure. And I almost feel like I cheated, but then Henry reminds me that I actually did some work on this too, you know, with setting a bunch of stuff up and ideas and prep and development and all that. So I'll take that as a win.
Yeah. Andre and I's relationship, even though we've been working for a year and change, because we've been with each other so much, it's what I would imagine would be like a 5-year friendship would be. We've seen each other more than we've seen our wives, and we started developing the documentary on paper months before we started shooting it. So by the time we went into production, it was kind of like Borg. We were on the same wavelength, and we just looked, and we knew that we had each other's back. And I'm a very passionate creative, and Andre's a very patient one. And those two skills together is exactly what we needed to be able to articulate and execute this documentary. And I feel so grateful that he let me contribute as much as I could creatively as well.
Well, I mean, like I said, once you got comfortable with that, of not trying to grip on something or, you know, I think anybody that's in a position of, I don't know, management or administration or directing or filmmaking, you know, you're not, unless you're doing everything on your own, then you can do it that way. But I am now a total proponent of letting go a little bit, you know, trusting the people around you, you know, letting them bring in what their thoughts and their skill and their talents, because on the technical side, I'm not as proficient as, you know, some. I am more than others, but, you know, creatively and vision-wise and big picture and 5, 6, 7 steps down the road, I'm pretty solid there, you know, in my mind. But, you know, how do you execute that?
Sure.
And you've got to find the right people. And I got really lucky with people that were passionate and very skilled on both sides of the, you know, proficiency sides of creativity and technical skill, and then execution of both, which is another thing, you know, that you not necessarily have. And, you know, to put it all together, because, you know, and to step away and just trust in that process, and you know what you're going to do. And, you know, there was times where Henry was like, we don't want to do that. And a lot of people were like, yeah, we do. That's what I said we want to do, or I want this, let's do it. I would step back and go, okay, tell me why, just so I can understand it. Sure. And then that will help, you know, another idea or something that may or may not be good coming out of my brain.
And it made it better for me too, because then we would have those conversations. And there'd be a couple times where I'd say, we don't want to do that. And he said, let's have the conversation. And I'd hear his point. And then the next day at 4 a.m., I'm in the edit, and I was like, he's completely right. And right. I would switch it back to what he was saying. We would respect each other and hear each other out. And I think that's what shows in the doc. Also, our crew is all fans of the movie. And that's something to talk about. We have Wes, who was working with us. We have Aaron, who was working with us. So when you're talking about how this doesn't feel like a fan doc and it feels like something else, it's because the fans were filmmakers themselves. So we were trying to find out how to artistically show that story as opposed to just have somebody obsessing about a story in front of the camera. And that's where we got that very scripted single camera look that I think really is the paramount aesthetic of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely elevates it to another level. And, you know, it's just, it's really interesting to hear about the process. Well, guys, I mean, this is it's been incredible. I'm actually now sitting in my home office surrounded by my own Monster Squad stuff. So it's kind of surreal to be, you know, talking about Monster Squad surrounded by all this stuff. But, you know, I can't wait for more people to see the film. And, you know, for right now, I think we mentioned it before, but let's go ahead and mention it again. Where can people, you know, keep track of the doc?
Well, they can keep track of, you know, the festivals that we're going to now and kind of some BTS stuff that we post, you know, now that we've screened and it's out there so people can get some stills and some experiences. All of the social handles are at the squad doc. So that's two D's in there. So at the squad doc. And, you know, we keep that posted. We keep that updated. If we make announcements or, I mean, we went kind of hog wild this week with, you know, posting and reposting on stuff because we were so jazzed that we, you know, won the audience award at Overlook, which was just amazing.
Sure.
But, you know, as we go through the next thing, you know, we'll flow out information. And, you know, as we get selected, you know, hopefully to more festivals, you know, we always announce that. If people want to chime in, if they have their own experiences, please follow us there and post on there.
If you know Young Hercules, please tweet him.
If you've got, you know, some stories of your own, you know, save those or let us know, because that's something that I'd like to use later on down the line when we have a released product that, you know, we can actually add even more, you know, potentially squad stories from fans that they can send in their own and just upload to our site, things like that, which, you know, that just kind of brings them into more, you know, even more into the clubhouse, right? And yeah. I don't think a lot of films, let alone documentaries, you know, have that ability or even that execution to be able to do something like that. And this kind of brings, you know, kind of a good wrap up point, because you said something very early on that I think I'm gonna steal, because you said it better than I've been trying to explain it. You said this was the documentary and the execution of the story, you know, you normally see a fan doc. And I don't really consider this a fan doc because, you know, usually those are just talking heads or talking fans gushing about a movie.
Sure.
Well, this was about the experience. But you said something that I really liked and I appreciate it. And like I said, I'm stealing it. You said this is something that, you know, doesn't talk to the fans.
Yeah.
It talks with the fans,
right,
and connects with them. And they're the ones doing the talking. You know, this isn't, you know, a heavy chapter thing with a big VO and a narration and, you know, Morgan Freeman explaining the experience of, you know, this thing.
It's the people
telling, it's the fans telling their own stories. And, you know, it's not heavy handed and it works. And, Henry and the team and myself have kind of ended up with something that hopefully works for you.
And Mike, we just want to thank you too, man. It's people like you and Bigger Show that get the word out there, and your relationship with the doc and Monster Squad itself just means so much to us, and thank you for everything you do.
Well, you know, I'll continue to sing the praises of the doc, you know, until it's long after it's out. It's been a real joy getting to see the film and getting to talk to y'all about it. And like I said, I can't wait for people to see it. You know, that should be pretty soon. Check your local listings for festivals and see if you catch Wolfman's Got Nards along the way. Henry, Andre, thank you guys so much for coming back. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you. And tweet Santa.
Thanks, Mike. We'll see you soon.
Yeah, absolutely. For Bigger Show, this has been Mike D, and we will see you next time. Goodbye. We're going to need a big show.